From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel. We're joined, as not usual, by our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Not usual, Ben is not here.
There's the unusual Ben-shaped hole in time-space that is here, but alas, he is elsewhere. You are you. Right?
Yeah, and you're here.
And you're here. Man, it's so hard without Ben. That makes this stuff they don't want you to know.
That's it.
Did I do okay?
You did great.
Did
man.
I do Ben proud? I hope so.
Oh, he's going to be so proud of you.
A special listener mail dish.
That's exactly what this is. Oh, man.
Well, not a listener mail, listener voicemail. We're taking it a step further.
That's right.
As an audio component.
We had to step it up to voicemail. It's so much more fun to hear you talking with us rather than us reading in your voice, essentially,
yeah,
from an email.
Exactly.
We prefer this. And just to remind you, this is what our outgoing voicemail message sounds like when you do call our number, 1-833-STDWYTK.
You've reached stuff they don't want you to know. You can turn back now or leave a message after the beep.
And this is what happens when, you know, maybe you made the wrong decision.
Oh, God, I should have turned back.
Just for fun.
Yeah, no, it's true. He took the red pill, and now his mind is wrecked.
That's right.
You can never come back. You can never unknow the stuff they don't want you to know. That's why it's the stuff they don't want you to know.
That's right. And today we're going to be looking at some serious suggestions for episodes that we may cover in the future. We're going to be looking at just some strange occurrences that happened on the voicemail system.
Some lighter fare, some stuff on the wackier, more comedic side. You know, we can take a joke as good as the rest of them in the conspiracy space.
To be honest, it's definitely my favorite. A little bit of light, happy things in my day.
Especially considering some of the stuff that you're working on outside of the show, Matt. Not to peek behind the curtain too far, but you're sort of mired in some real grisly stuff.
Yeah. And you guys are my counseling. So thank you. Keep it up. And let's go ahead and get started with one of those counseling sessions from Sean.
Hey there. My name is Sean Cutches. I was wondering if you guys could do research into a religion called the Baha'i Faith. I was brought up in it, and I've only been able to find so much information. I'd love to know what you guys think about it. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. First of all, this is going to be sort of a little bit of a snippet kind of show. That absolutely is something that deserves its own episode. It's fascinating, and it is one of these things where it's a religion that makes it onto lists sometimes that refer to it as a cult. And I think the reason for that is because, fairly or otherwise, the person in charge or the person that created this faith is a relatively modern individual, historically speaking, right?
Yeah, it only goes back to the 1800s. 1863 is when it was officially founded. And, you know, over the scope of human history and when a lot of the what you would call the big R religions, the capital R religions were formed, this is significantly further in the future. It was founded in Iran, and it's got some interesting things about it. It's got some interesting characteristics.
Well, it sort of started as a bit of a protest religion in some ways because the gentleman that founded it was born Mirza Hussein Ali in 1817 to a family of Persian nobility. He came from great privilege and received, as you know, was traditional in that part of the world, an Islamic education. But it wasn't the kind of very, very strict and technical education that others might have. But despite that, he became completely fascinated by his studies and took it even further. He became a very, very renowned poet and calligrapher. He learned swordsmanship and became a very, very talented horseman. And he came to something of a divine revelation through studying the Quran and Arabic. So at the age of 27, the man who would go on to become Baha'u'llah became a follower of a very influential leader named the Bab. And just a little bit more background, the Bab was born Sayyid Ali Muhammad Shirazi, and he founded something that ended up being a precursor to the Baha'i faith known as Babism. And he had all these writings and papers, and when he passed away, Baha'u'llah carried on his teachings, became this very, very devout follower of his. Then Baha'u'llah was imprisoned because he was perceived as having had a hand in an attempt on the life of the Shah of Iran.
Oh, wow.
And he was locked in basically a dungeon that was referred to, the translation is the Black Pit. And while he was in there, he came up with all of these chants and prayers that he shared with some of the other folks that were imprisoned in there. And it became this very unifying experience where they all could achieve peace and not fear for their lives and have this kind of almost Zen flow state that they achieved together.
Wow. Peace through suffering. That's intense.
And while he was in prison, Baha'u'llah actually had a vision of what he refers to as the Most Great Spirit, which is in the form of a woman, like sort of descending from on high, who told him that he had a divine mission and that he would be given assistance from beyond.
Wow. And then he created a new faith, like through all of that.
He did, and there's a lot more that goes into this. That's why it really does deserve its own episode.
Mm-hmm.
He was exiled. He was forced to live in Baghdad, Iraq, for 10 years, and that's where he met some other followers of the Bab religion, and then he became seen as basically a prophet.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we've noticed over the years that a lot of these movements begin with one person generally, right, who's then seen as more than just a teacher, but more than that, right? And I think that this fits the bill. Some of the really cool stuff about the Baha'i faith, when you just look at it on the surface, is that it's very much, or at least it outwardly says to be a unifying religion or a unifying belief system. It's about equality, that genders and, you know, there's only one race of humankind, right? And it believes that all of the prophets that have come through, everyone from Abraham and Moses to Zoroaster, Jesus and the prophet Muhammad, each one of these was just an iteration and getting to see aspects of God through the actions and the teachings of these different prophets. And it's all one single God that all of these prophets have essentially been worshiping and following. It's really cool. But again, there's not a ton – well, there is a lot of information. Like if you go to bbc.co.uk, they've even got a whole like outline, a whole page here that just tells you all about the Baha'i faith. And on here it mentions that there are around 6 million Baha'i in the world in 235 countries and around 6,000 that live in Britain alone. Again, it's the BBC website. So I guess Sean, who wrote to us, I'd like to know more about your personal experience, I think, in the Baha'i faith. I'd like to know what kinds of things are you taught? What are the worship sessions like? I'd like to learn more from you. But Noel, you have a connection to it as well, right?
Yeah, I do. I feel like we've talked a lot about on the show the difference between, or the distinctions that are drawn between, the idea of a religion and the idea of a cult, and where one person's religion is another person's cult. And to me, cult is always used as a term of abuse, and religion tends to be raised up as something that has a little bit more legitimacy. And I think the use of cult is very unfair in this sense, because it is ultimately kind of an open-ended type faith where people of all faiths and backgrounds are welcome. And one of my daughter's best friends comes from that community as well. And I've been with her to many of these kind of devotional type sessions where we sit and they pass around different readings from Baha'u'llah. He's got some really great little aphorisms and kind of very, you know, it's all about peace and getting along with your neighbor and accepting people for who they are and all of that. But also peppered within there are quotes from the Bible and quotes from the Quran and quotes from all kinds of different religious texts. And the real emphasis on it is not worship per se. It's much more about open discussion and talking about how to make the world a better place and get along with your neighbor and, you know, see the best in people. And it's a very empathetic, kind of kind-hearted experience. And I've always left it feeling very good. And the kids that come to this thing are all activists. They're all in the community. Yeah. They're doing good work. There's this real kind of focus on reaching out to your community and being part of the solution and not using a religion as a form of division. So dude, I've found it to be really nice and had nothing but good experiences. And I am not a religious person at all. In fact, I'm quite the opposite. And I even brought that up even like the first time I went, where I said something like, you know, this is, I kind of forgot the good parts about religion. That's the word I used. And this really reminded me of the things I liked about going to church before I kind of turned from it when I was younger and realized a lot of the negative parts. And I was told, well, this isn't really a religion. That's not what this is at all. This is much more of just a community of people that are trying to solve problems and kind of see the good in the world.
Can I just tell you? Okay. So on the day we're recording this episode, our other episode, our interview with John Bryant, is coming out, and he's a musician that joined Nexium for a short time. I guess not that short, but for a time, and then left it after a lot of the controversy came out. And he wrote an album about it. It's really interesting. But in those discussions, when we were interviewing him, we were talking about that moniker cult, right? And its application. And I think it was pretty universally agreed upon that Nexium was a cult because of the revelations about, you know, its leader, the person that created it and was the head. And really what I'm trying to say here is that his feelings – I don't know if you remember this, Noel – his feelings of going to the Nexium meetings, to learning, feeling like he was sharing in a community and all that stuff, it sounds similar. And I think that's the basis of what we're talking about here, that want to be within a community, to have that tribe, to have like-minded people that you can just discuss things with and learn things with. You know, I think all religious movements like this have that in common, no matter what the, you know, the leaders are doing, either in open or behind closed doors. So it's just it's interesting to me.
Yeah. And I haven't found anything in my research about this that indicated that Baha'u'llah was anything but kind of a person that connected people together and encourage people to do good work. And usually what happens when you start using the, throwing around the cult word, is the leader is doing something shady and the leader is being usurious in some way, or is capitalizing on the fact that he's got this pull and this power over people and using it for his own, whether it's, you know, carnal pleasure or personal enrichment or what have you. But that's not the experience that I've had in reading about this particular faith.
Heard, man. And I don't want to take that away from you or anybody else that believes that. I think for me, cult comes into it when there's deification of a leader. When like we heard about with Vanguard, remember how he had all of these mystic stories about him that clearly were not true about reading when he was like 1 year old or something. I mean, which is possibly true, but some of the other stuff was just – it turned out to be false.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And it just – one of those things, if you have enough light on something, especially when it's being deified in that way, you might learn the truth is a little different.
And just to sew this up, and again, this really is worth its own episode, but there's not a conspiracy here per se, but it is an interesting way to get into that conversation about the difference between a cult and a religion or a faith. And while, you know, this particular faith is very open to other faiths, in fact, they believe that God is transcendent and not actually knowable, but that he has sent, I don't know, spokespeople, I guess, or conduits, you know, in the form of various great prophets throughout history, including Krishna, Zoroaster, Jesus Christ, they accept, Buddha, Muhammad, the Bab, as mentioned earlier, who was kind of the precursor to this with Babism, and Baha'u'llah. And I think what maybe bugs some people is the idea that Baha'u'llah sort of christened himself to be God's conduit, and that rubs people the wrong way. And I don't know how I feel about that aspect of it in general, but the product of that I've seen in the way that the people I've interacted with have used it has been very positive. And it's a lot of people that aren't actually members of the faith per se that come to these meetings because they're just nice. They're good people and it's good conversation. And the woman who has these at her apartment just makes beautiful Persian food, and she's a retired doctor, and just all really upstanding, great people. And I know I sound like I'm just, you know, singing its praises, but I've had nothing but good experiences with it. So thank you so much for writing in. I hope that that your experience has been like what my experience was.
Yes, we certainly hope that. All right, now Sean, we're jumping away from the Baha'i Faith. We're coming back to somebody new. We're going to listen to a message that we got. I think it was around 2 in the morning when this message came through. I'm just going to play it.
Hey, my name's Alex, a big fan of yours. I just wanted to call because I noticed there's one conspiracy that it seems like y'all seem to avoid at every chance possible, one that you yourselves perpetrate. I'm talking, of course, of the mysterious life of Ben Bolin. From everything from lived in Peru for a few years to impersonating members of the cloth to, I'm paraphrasing here, but having a job where when people were in trouble and no one else could help, they would call. When are we going to get an episode about who was Ben Bolin? Also, sorry about the audio quality. I got my phone wrapped in foil to keep George Soros out. Y'all have a good
one. Well, first of all, every episode is a chronicle of the history of what was and is Ben Bolin.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And, you know, people think of him as this mysterious guy, just this man living his life that's just, you know, been
on the fringes.
Mired and on the, yeah, been mired with both tragedy and wonders. But, you know, he's just your everyday fellow, you know, just he's Ben Bolin.
He's Ben Bolin. He may or may not be imbued with some metaphysical abilities to blip in and out of existence and open Ben-shaped portals in time-space. I can neither confirm nor deny any of this.
No, we can't confirm or deny any trips intergalactic or, you know, whatsoever.
Yeah.
Where he, you know, has to speak with other representatives from other galaxies. He doesn't do that, right?
No. I mean, I don't know. I can't speak. I haven't seen it personally. But it's, you know, Ben's a very multifaceted character. Yes, on the one hand, he is Ben Bolin, as we love and know him, our pal and friend and compatriot. But sometimes he goes off the grid.
Yeah.
Like right now, for example. I don't know where the hell he is and what he's up to.
He could be anywhere and everywhere all at once.
He could be anytime.
He really could be. And honestly, you know, think of it this way. If you don't know where Ben is at any given point in time, he's probably behind you, just sitting there, watching, listening.
I want you to marinate on that a little bit while we take a quick sponsor break. And we're back, as Matt would say, with no delay. I think he said that once, and I just liked it so much. I wasn't sure if that was where you cribbing that from a hip-hop thing or something. Or
I think I'm just talking about the aspect of we got to edit it this way so that we came back immediately after the ad break.
That's right. Okay. That's fair. Because through the magic of podcasting, time is not really a thing we have to worry about.
That's right. And one thing we do have to worry about is all the trash that's just piling up on this planet. It's filling up the oceans. It's clogging up the interstate. And that's why we're going to listen to this next call.
Hey, guys. Love listening to your show. One thing I've always wondered, and is it a conspiracy, is plasma trash recycling, the plasma arc trash recycling. Basically, where you use plasma to burn off all your trash. I mean, they've got systems in Oregon and I think in Washington and around the world. They got one in France. But why isn't this a big thing? I mean, I don't think the cost is that great, but maybe it's the trash guys that just don't want to start doing this kind of stuff and they want to keep taking your land or whatnot. I don't know. So maybe you guys can look into it a little more and see why we aren't doing this thing that would help the planet and help us to, you know, get rid of landfills. So anyway, thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here and say it's also being used in Japan and even more places than our caller mentioned, our anonymous caller there. Thank you for calling, by the way. Plasma waste converters are fascinating, and we've known about them for a long time here at Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Ben and I actually got to talk to a professor at Georgia Tech who was one of the original people creating this technology. So let's talk about what it is really fast, Noel. They there are these devices that use a process called plasma gasification to treat trash. And it literally breaks the trash down into its molecular parts. So you're talking about nitrogen, carbon, all kinds of gases that are created through this. And then you get this one other thing called slag, which is – it kind of looks like obsidian basically, like a black stone.
Yeah, it's used in like metal production or like the slag pits, or it's like an offshoot of, I believe, industrial ironworks and things like that.
Yeah, it can be used in that stuff. It can be used in all kinds of different things. One of the biggest, I guess, possible future uses for this stuff would be for building materials on homes and on streets, on, you know, rather than asphalt, using this kind of substance. And it could be huge. Imagine if we lived in a world where all the trash that we create every day, and all of us do it, no matter how awesome you are at attempting to help the planet by reducing, you are creating trash just in your everyday life. And imagine if we could take all of that and just turn it into building materials. That would be awesome. Because when the other thing is, when you create the gases by shooting this plasma at trash, you can generate power. Because the gas can be sent off at high pressure to run a turbine. And there you go. You've got electricity. How cool is that? It's amazing. But there are a bunch of problems with it. And when I say a bunch, I mean one giant problem. And that's just how expensive it is to get it up and running.
Right.
In 2017, the Bahamas was looking into getting just one plasma trash converter system, essentially a pilot project running.
To the tune of $650
million. Yes, $650 million. And I think – and this has honestly been the problem since this technology was created. It costs so much money to get going, then you're going to only incrementally make your money back over decades. And there are a lot of places, localities – you know, local governments, state governments, whatever, national governments that aren't willing to make that kind of investment to then only make it back over a long period of time.
No, because at the end of the day, municipal waste is a business in some sense, and it's all about cost analysis, cost-benefit analysis or whatever. And there was a statement that was made regarding this Bahamian project by a group called the WRDG. Do you know what that stands for, man? WRDG.
It's probably like waste something something group.
There you go. That's plenty good. Just saying that it's not commercially viable, that it makes no economic sense, and they were quoted in saying, show us the facility that has worked and that has, you know, sustained over time. And they could not point to one. And it was, you know, it ultimately said, oh, also you need 1,500 tons per day of combustibles in order to feed the facility.
Well, and that's to make the energy production work.
And they only produce about 500 tons per day of combustible waste. That means they would have to mine more materials in order to actually make the system work where it was generating that amount of energy.
Yeah, but I see your point, guys, in the Bahamas. It's just, imagine if you could take all of the plastic waste in the ocean and gather it all up and then just start running it through these machines and getting slag and energy out of it. I don't see why we wouldn't, as a species, decide that that's an important thing to do, because it seems viable enough to me. We have billions and trillions of dollars to throw around. We're just using it for a different means.
Yeah, like war and stuff. But you know, it's a long game proposition, right? Where it makes sense for the planet, which also kind of should be looked at it as a long game proposition, taking care of the planet and all that. Also, I don't know if you saw, there's a study that doesn't seem to be making the rounds very widely, that we have achieved kind of critical levels of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Just happened.
I haven't seen it on the news really at all. It seems like it's a bit of a buried lead. But
how do you even talk about it?
Well, it's just depressing. And it literally says that within 40 years, the planet could become uninhabitable because of this. Not being alarmist here, that's just what the climate scientists are saying and the research behind this. Also, this is something I'd like to do an episode on. Apparently, Exxon Mobil knew about this in 1984. They had a study out where they knew that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere over time would be this bad by now, and they did nothing to stop it.
Short game?
That's what I'm saying. That's my point, though. It should be a long game. The idea that the argument is, oh, it doesn't make sense in the short term for us to make money, but shouldn't the proposition really be, well, let's maybe lose a little money in the short term for a long-term benefit?
Yeah.
And that's what you're saying, and I completely agree, but that's not how business works, is it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's really depressing. And it's been this way since 2007 when I first learned about this technology with Jonathan Strickland, who wrote an article on How Stuff Works about this. And then Ben and I got to go interview the guy. And I haven't seen anything really, any big news story about plasma conversion technology since then. So it's all good. Or as Ben would say, everything is terrible and we're all going to die.
He does usually say that, doesn't he? Maybe the truth lies somewhere in the middle, and I believe the children are our future.
Thank you, anonymous person, whoever you are, for writing into us. That's a cool topic, and maybe we can talk about it more in the future. It might be worth digging into and, I don't know, attacking with some plasma. Let's attack this with some plasma torches. Okay, now let's move on to the next one. This message, I'm not sure what happened with our phone lines, but we seemed to intercept a conversation that we weren't supposed to.
Thanks for calling Beasley Food Enterprise. How can I help you? How can I direct your call? Sir? Hello? I'm sorry. I can't understand what you're saying. Do you speak English? Okay. No, I'm sorry. I don't speak Enochian. In fact, I've never heard of that. How can I direct your call, sir? No, I'm sorry, Mr. Lightbringer is not in the office today. Can I take a message? Mr. Payman, and you're from Long Pig Industries. Okay, and this is regarding, oh, it's our meat supply. Okay. Okay, I will let him know. I'm sorry, was there something else? Global Illumination Unlimited? I'm sorry, they're our sister company. I can redirect you. Hold on a second. Please hold. Thank you.
Well, like I said, that conversation I don't think was meant for our ears.
No.
And
my ears actually, when they say your ears are burning, my ears actually started burning. They started getting really hot. I started smelling sulfur, and it was a very strange experience. In fact, the speaker on the phone, when I picked it up and we listened to it on speakerphone, kind of black goo started oozing out of it.
You got that too?
Yeah. It was a real problem. No, now that I think about it, I did it on my laptop, and I think it really might have messed up my keyboard. Like, I have been having problems with it ever since. It's really sticky and... Ugh.
Oh, man. Well, all I know is that Long Pig Industries – and did you hear Illumination Global Unlimited in
there?
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about them in a while. Thought they kind of bailed on us, but I guess they're always kind of around the corner, aren't they?
I guess they are. Oh, that's okay. Maybe the best thing to do is just to move on. That was too disturbing.
Let's pretend like it never happened.
Okay, let's go to Brandon. Brandon, what do you got for us?
Hey, Matt, Ben, Noel, and super producer Paul. Long story short, I've worked at cell phone companies, corporate locations for about the past 5 years up until recently. And there is a lot of stuff that they don't want you to know in the cell phone industry. And after listening to some of your shows for the past 6 years that you guys have made, I haven't really seen too many shows on the cell phone industry in general. So I just wanted to be a personal source of information. If you guys ever did think about making a show like that, I used to work at Verizon Corporate from 2013 to 2016. And then after that, I transferred to a place called US Cellular, which is a regional cell phone carrier from 2016 to 2018. So yeah, I definitely have a handle on sales practices, techniques, scandal, and if you guys had any information on that, I would be more than happy to give that to you guys.
Okay, So these little devices we've all got here, it seems like there may be more something behind them.
I know it's a podcast, but Matt just picked up his little device and he's holding it right next to his face.
Yeah, I really am.
Rubbing it gently, lovingly.
Getting some of that radiation out of this baby. I'm interested to know, I guess what – I'm assuming a lot of the things that this person would be talking about are – like how much a phone costs, how much – like how these companies make their money back. Perhaps the manufacturing process. I don't know exactly what the cell phone industry doesn't want me to know besides the fact that text messaging should not cost anything or much at all because of how little stuff is actually transmitted unless, of course, you're sending – GIFs and videos and all those things via text messaging, then it's a lot of data.
Well, that's what I do. I send constant GIFs to everybody.
I've seen it.
Yep. I'm a giffer. Win one for the giffer. That's me.
You know, you also do – this is cool that we can talk about this. You also do a thing that not a lot of my other friends do, and you will put ideas – like a single idea and then send and then like almost like sentence structure with sending so that when you're talking to me, I get all of the thoughts broken up, which is actually a lot easier to read.
It's not annoying? Are you sure?
No, it's a lot easier for me to read and to understand. I end up typing out a paragraph or two before I send a text generally.
And then, yeah, when it's small print like that, it's hard to like get the meat of it in one glance. You know?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I thought it was annoying because it like, looks like, I feel like I'm blowing up people's phones, but I do try to make them little text nuggets, you know?
I think it's a factor. I don't know. Maybe just because I haven't been as immersed in a lot of the social networking, a lot of the ways of communication with other people via this little phone. But it's more appealing. I would just have to say that. And also, good work. I'm going to try and start incorporating that into my life a little more. Hey, let us know what you think. How do you text? Is it a bunch of stuff and emojis all in one big block? Or do you get your points across succinctly in like single thoughts basically? But maybe a whole series of them. Hey, how do you use your phone? And what do you think they don't want you to know about either how you're using it or why you've even got one in the first place? Let's find out more of the stuff they don't want you to know about phones. Thank you so much for calling in. And with that, we're going to take a quick break and hear from a sponsor. All right, we are back, and let's go ahead and get started with a message from Patrick.
Hi, I'm Patrick Keenan. As you can tell, I'm an excellent musician, but I'm also a big fan of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And I was listening to the Finders episode. In that Finders episode, during a very brief side conversation, I would say, you alluded to the fact that, you know, maybe a Mr. Ted Cruz could be possible for the second iteration of Zodiac murders, as in being the second iteration of the Zodiac killer. I fully support this this theory, and in fact, I would say that you guys have been dealing in finer detail, and so I think sometimes you miss the larger picture. It's clear to me that Mr. Ted Cruz has leapt through time, as you say, but not in the same way that you think he did. What he had was connections. Obviously, his father being the true assassin of John F. Kennedy, everybody's records had to be changed. And it just so happened that Ted Cruz became born in 1970 when he was, in fact, born 4 years earlier. So that would put him at 5 years old when he was apprenticing under the previous Zodiac killer. And a lot of people don't know this, but the previous Zodiac killer was one of the victims that was passing the torch on to Ted Cruz. And, of course, Ted Cruz has become a lot more healed and probably a better person than I'm painting him out to be. You have permission to use every second of this audio. Thank you. Goodbye.
Every second? Well. And every second of that audio was a pure joy. Yeah, I don't know about all that. That's really interesting.
Well, okay, so I'm trying to remember our conversation.
I know we talked about that, like babies sitting on each other's shoulders wearing a suit.
he was a baby.
That's what it was. He would have been a baby.
Yeah, because the first murders occurred before he was born.
That's
so then
right.
It was some weird in utero thing.
Sure.
God, I can't even.
He had to recruit some of his baby buds to, like, you know, do the whole shoulder thing, posing as an adult serial killer. and then they have to figure out how to get the weird bag mask on, yeah. And, like, you know, how to wield a Bowie knife. And I mean, there's a lot going into this equation here. Matt, you're the Zodiac expert. in case people don't know, what do you think about this theory?
Well, I like Patrick, who, by the way, is, but you can tell by the first second of that tape, a fantastic musician. His idea that perhaps Ted Cruz was...
What was that, chopsticks? That's not chopsticks. It's the other one you learn. You learn chopsticks, and then you learn that one. That's the one you can play with your knuckles.
That's it.
Just on the black keys.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, oh, the black keys.
Sorry to interrupt.
Really, really great band. But... This idea that a five-year-old Ted Cruz, whose date of birth was changed because of his father's involvement with the assassination of JFK, as a five-year-old was apprenticing under the original Zodiac Killer, then became the second iteration of the Zodiac Killer. I want Patrick, I want you to write a comic or a novel of some sort and then get back to us because I think you should expand on this idea and I'm on board. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much for listening and for sending us that awesome message. All right, let's find the next one. Okay, now this message comes from a gentleman that we are going to refer to as Herman, and it's a bit long. There are three messages that he left that all build on each other, and Herman is... he's got a fascinating job, and he's calling us to comment on our Who Will Control the Arctic episode.
Yeah, it's sort of about sovereignty, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just go ahead and listen to that. His voice will be changed.
To protect the innocent.
That's right.
Hi, guys. I'm calling in regards to the Who Controls the North Pole episode. I've listened to it a few days ago. I've been humming and hawing about calling, but I've been a fan of the show for a long time, so I figured I'd give you guys a quick chime. This is going to have to be a two-parter. I've already tried twice to fit it into 3 minutes, and it just doesn't work. I'm a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Canada. And if you guys didn't know, which I'm sure you do, but still, the RCMP is responsible for a lot of policing duties, including federal investigations in Canada, but also doing regular policing duties in the Northern Territories, where we have all of our North Polar Arctic Circle land, such as Baffin Island, Ellesmere Island, and so on. So the story I'm going to tell you is not from me, but it's from a very good friend and colleague of mine, where he used to work as a regular patrol officer up in Nunavut, which is one of the territories, on one of those northern islands. Well, one morning in the summer when the ice had thawed, he came across two men that had come ashore on the shore of the island. Now, this is unusual in many ways. First off, this is a very, very remote and small community. We're talking about maybe 100 people on the entire island. It's what we call a fly-in community, which means that there are obviously no roads, but the quickest and easiest way is just to fly in there. But it's about a two-day boat ride if you want to do it through water. So this is very unusual. It's also very unusual because the two guys are neither Inuit or locals. So most white people that are out there work for the government and are on a rotation. It's just the way it is. And so he goes to them. They're not in a makeshift raft, but not a very big boat. He described it to me as being little more than a covered-up rowboat. And again, this adds to the unusual because we're talking about basically open Arctic Ocean. So he walks up to them thinking that they're in distress or something, but again, you know, kind of puzzled about what's going on. So the two guys, he goes up to them and he says, "Well, do you guys need help?" And at first they're saying, no, we're good. And obviously this is too odd. So he's like, no, this is okay, something's up. So he starts drilling them, trying to figure out what's going on. And so eventually they say, well, we got lost fishing and we're just taking a break. And so he's like, but there's no fishing here. This is open ocean. And there is no fishing really up there on account of the ice and whatnot. A lot of seal and whale hunting, but no fishing. So this is extremely suspicious, but, you know, he's got no real grounds to arrest them or anything like that. They're just very strange. He also notices that they have a heavy Russian accent. So my friend, being a very clever guy, and I say this, you know, I think every word of it, he's a very intelligent individual, very good investigator. He starts drilling them, and at first they really don't want to give up any kind of information or anything like that. But eventually, you get to a point where they finally admit being Russian nationals, and their official reason for being there was that they decided to go on an exploration of the Arctic. Well, again, in little more than a covered rowboat, might I say, so, you know, odd at best, but this became kind of a known issue, if you will, where we, the RCMP and the Canadian military, are well aware that Russian nationals and Russian expeditions, now all unofficial, mind you, but Russian expeditions do, on a fairly regular basis, come ashore in the northern islands of Canada. And our best guess on why they do this is because they want to make sure that we're still asserting sovereignty on this land. They probably were hoping that by coming ashore on an uninhabited island, they could challenge the fact that it was actually Canadian. Because, you know, what defines sovereignty on land? So, yeah, I made this story very, very short. There's a few more details, but basically that's the gist of it. And again, this is a fairly common occurrence, at least more frequent than one would think. So, yeah, the Russian government has always denied any implication in this. I'm not saying it happens, like, every week. But, again, it happens more frequently than you would believe. And, yeah, it's a very, very valid argument. And I thought that your research was actually really on point as far as the Arctic Circle game that's going on in Russia and China's claims to it.
All right. Well, there you have it. Story from Herman.
What is your take on that, man?
I'm fascinated by this. I really am sad that Ben is not here because I think he would expound on this a lot. Just this concept of testing whether or not sovereignty is still being enforced in a place like the Arctic. We literally talked about that on the show. And this is a gentleman who works in law enforcement up there who is stating that, yes, that very thing is happening between Canada and Russia right now.
It's interesting. This isn't quite the same thing as sovereignty, but it sort of is, sort of more states' rights. Ben and I did an episode on Ridiculous History the other day about this weird conflict between Ohio and Michigan over a strip of land because of the way the borders were drawn inaccurately because the maps at the time weren't right. There became this little strip of land where Toledo was that was up for grabs or up for debate as to who owned it, as to which state it belonged to. And they ended up doing something where one state just decided to set up a militia and start like going about it as though they owned it. And it's that kind of pushing the buttons and testing to see, you know, who is going to flex and like, are you going to stop us? Exactly. Anyone's going to come along and do something about it. And obviously it's this guy's part of the Royal Mounted Police to do something about it, right? And to exercise their sovereignty.
Well, yeah, it's part of his job. It seems like, and some of the other people he was mentioning in the message, man, and what a job too. Just like going around in a boat in the Arctic or a ship in the Arctic and testing those waters or just making sure that sovereignty is being enforced.
It's like, hey, you're not supposed to be here.
Yeah,
get exactly. Out of here, you Russians.
Oh, really? You're fishing, huh? Okay. Well, I'm going to hang out while you guys finish up, okay? Well,
what's the potential, like, wrongdoing there? Can you explain that to me?
My only thought, and again, I really wish Ben was here, is that you could set up some kind of small facility or outpost on an island like that or a small area that isn't very populated if you were trying to do that for one reason or another, or maybe even some kind of underwater thing. I don't know exactly what it would be. I can't really envision it, but I'm sure there are a lot of uses for it. especially when you're talking about oil rig drilling, and probably military, for military uses.
Do you think that's what was happening here?
I don't know, but you know what? Maybe we should try and get Herman to reach back out to us. We could do a whole episode on it.
Yeah, it might be nice to actually have a little back and forth with him instead of just hearing the kind of condensed version of the story, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, thanks, Herman. Get back at us with a burner phone or wherever, however else you want to contact us.
We'll set something up and we'll give you – I think we did already in the magic of post, gave you kind of a voice disguise, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, let's get back to the next message. Now, this one just – I'm going to put this out there. I don't have a lot of research on this topic yet. I remember hearing about it back in the day and collecting a bunch of links, but I haven't connected anything together to talk about on this episode. This, what you're about to hear, is essentially a preview of a show that I think we should do in the near future.
Hi, guys. I was just listening back to an older episode about the sonic weapons on Cuba and the LRAD device. Something I was kind of listening to one day and while I was kind of cued on to was the documentary about a movie that was to be made called Gray State. This movie that in the end never was made because the producer, the filmmaker, was and his family were killed in a suicide type of homicide situation. It was very tragic. But in the documentary regarding the film and the family and such, they have some clips that they pulled off of a blog site that freaked me out a little bit, just because in these clips, these people were clearly experiencing hallucinations of sorts and reclusion and depression, all kind of at the snap of a finger, it seemed. And what freaked me out about this was because exposure to a high volume of extremely low decibel sounds for a long period of time causes these exact things. So what is the chance that that device could be used on a personal situation like that? Anyway, just glad to cue it in. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Thank you for calling in, anonymous person. The topic that you're talking about here, the movie called Gray State that was going to be created by and directed by and I believe even to a portion edited by a man named David Crowley. It was in 2010, I believe, when David Crowley was actually working on this film. And recently in 2017, there was a documentary about the creation of that movie, or I guess the failed creation of that movie, called A Gray State came out. And it looks fascinating. I have not watched the entire documentary yet, but he's correct. Our caller is correct in saying that David Crowley and his entire family were all killed in what appears to be, at least officially, a series of homicides and then a suicide, with David Crowley being the person who took his own life after killing his family. And there's a lot of controversy about this occurrence, this tragedy that happened to David and his family, because of the nature of the subjects that are looked at in the movie Gray State that he was working on, essentially about how the United States was going to be controlled by a paramilitary force, or, you know, an ultra military force that of just tyranny, essentially. And he wanted to warn people that that was coming, and that's what the whole movie was about. So anyway, I think we should do an entire episode on this. By the way, Werner Herzog was an executive producer on A Gray State, that documentary. Noel, thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I really think this is something I need to look more into. And if Herzog has to do with the film, he is a master documentarian in addition to being a master narrative filmmaker, and usually has really interesting topics that he believes in. So, I mean, there must be something here, especially for a man to take such extreme action. You know, not to say that there's definitely a government cover-up, but at the same time, it could just be a story of someone's mental health deteriorating.
Again, I haven't seen the whole thing, but we're going to look into it, and hopefully you can too, and then we'll learn more together in an episode in the future. So thanks for calling in. This is the last one. We got to get out of here, guys. I'm sorry that our time is running out here in the studio. Let's do this last one from Mario and his family.
Hey, it's Mario. My son and I were just listening to the cell phones 5G cancer episode, and at 8 minutes and 5 seconds, there's an interesting thing that Noel, you say. He said, "Yoink!" So we were just wondering what that meant. We played it over and over and over again and just thought it was so funny. Anyways, just had to share. All right, talk to you later. Bye.
That little stab at the end.
Hey, listen, I am so glad to be such a non-ending source of amusement for all you out there in podcast land. Yeah, that's my secret code word that I'm just like dropping in conversation just to try to like mind control people. That's what yoink is.
Well, why don't we listen back to a clip of the episode and see what it actually sounded like.
I have no recollection of saying this. I got to hear this.
Okay, here it goes.
Would these have maybe looked like those crazy backpack phones you see in some war films?
Not nearly as advanced at that point.
But they would still be quite bulky and probably,
yes. Yeah, it needed huge antennas, right?
Okay. Wait, a yoi?
A yoi. Yeah, it's some sort. It's like a Sasquatch.
It just sounds like you're starting a thought and then you switched gears.
Yeah, as my landlord just pointed out to me the other day, I talk very fast. I think very fast. That sounds like I'm giving myself a compliment. But sometimes my mouth and my brain do not align and I need to walk it back real quick. And sometimes I do it in the form of a yoi.
I like it. Can I hear it one more time?
Please.
Just the yoi part.
You see in some war films?
Not nearly as advanced at that point.
But they would still be quite...
Ayoy.
Ayoy.
All right. Well, that's a new part of our vocabulary, everyone.
Ayoy and ahoy, mateys. Podcast mateys.
Ayoy and ahoy.
Ayoy and ahoy.
Going to go on a shirt.
We play the other one, though? There's a nice one about me.
Oh, there is a really nice one about you.
I don't know. This one made me feel good. And I'm nothing if not vain. So I'd love to end the show on this note.
Hey, guys. I don't know. I accidentally hung up when instead of pressing 3, so I don't know if you got the last one. It's okay. Not really that a big deal. And I just actually watched one of your YouTube videos. And you know how when you just listen to something or you read a book, you kind of visualize the characters or the people. And I got to say, Matt and Ben kind of look like what I thought you were, how I pictured you in my head. But Noel, I always pictured you as an Alec Baldwin type character. At one podcast, you mentioned you were divorced and you already had a kid that was 6 or something at the time, like a little 7-year-old kid or whatever. And it just made me think you're older, and the vocal fry, I think, added to the whole Alec Baldwin thing. I don't know. You're a handsome Hagrid type dude. Sorry, I got the wrong impression of you. Love you guys.
Well, you see, as it turns out, I actually am Alec Baldwin, and that's really the stuff that we don't want you to know.
I don't understand. It's Alec Baldwin talking to me, but I'm looking at a handsome Hagrid type.
He didn't say – did he say Hagrid?
Yeah, he said a handsome Hagrid type.
Oh, I thought he said handsome hybrid.
Oh.
Hagrid, that's not a compliment. I don't care for that one bit.
Like reptilian?
Hybrid, like I was sort of like an Alec Baldwin.
Oh.
I don't know, man. I was like a combination. Okay. Handsome Hagrid. Is Hagrid not handsome?
Or Hagrid? I don't know what he's saying.
He's saying Hagrid.
I think he's saying you're...
You know what? And now I'm coming back into my normal voice, and I'm upset about this.
He said handsome. He called you handsome.
It implies that I'm like some sort of weird gigantor or something like that.
What are you talking about? He's saying your beard is fantastic.
Well, okay.
And you're a younger man than he envisioned.
That's fair. I've lived a rough life.
That's right.
Hence the vocal fry and the child and the divorce.
Yeah.
I do my best, though. No, that's funny. It's true. And I understand that like kind of like disconnect between what you hear and what your eyes behold, especially when there's time that goes by and you've made this mental image of the person. Josh and Chuck from Stuff You Should Know always joke about how people get them flipped in their minds. And that's very true. But yeah, it's me. This is me. And you are you still.
That's right.
This has been Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. the Ben-shaped vortex is starting to pull us in to the abyss. I feel like he's summoning us to where he is on whatever astral plane he's currently occupying. So
that's
we better allow ourselves to be pulled into his maelstrom.
For some reason, I'm getting a hankering for some chips, like some I don't know, classic style chips,
like with the dips.
Yeah, with the dips.
I think isn't he more of like a, he like, I know he likes the sour cream and onion.
Yeah, I could see that. And maybe some pizza. You feeling pizza right
now?
He
likes the pizzerias.
Yeah.
The pizza chips. Vintage.
Oh, I've seen them.
They're hard to come by.
But if he
anyone,
finds them.
Well, of course he does. If anyone knows where to find pizzeria chips, it's Ben Bolin.
He's got that bag that he can just reach into and then stuff appears, materializes.
It's true. Yeah. That's like I said, Ben is a bit of a space folder. He can make things happen. But he will be returning to us very soon. And we will be returning to you very soon. In the meantime, if you want to hit us up on the social medias, you can do so. We are Conspiracy Stuff Show, I think, right?
On Instagram.
On Instagram. That's the one. If you want to hit me up on Instagram, feel like compelled to do so and see me in all my handsome Hagrid activities, you know, hanging out with Harry and the boys and Hermione and having adventures, you can do that. I'm at Embryonic Insider. Matt, what's yours?
Yeah, if you want to see, like pictures and videos and like sweet memes and stuff of me and my son playing lightsabers all day long, don't follow me because you won't see those pictures because I don't have a thing.
No, Matt keeps that stuff very close to the vest, understandably so. The internet is a hive of scum and villainy.
No, but it's also, not.
Yeah, of course it is. But it's also, you know what, like anything else, it's also a hive of delight. It's all about which corners of the internet you traverse. You can join our Facebook group where we are. Here's where it gets crazy. There's a lot of cool, you know, maybe not pictures of kids playing lightsaber, but there's definitely memes. Some of them may be vaguely Star Wars themed.
Yeah.
You never know. You can also do the Twitter, where I think we are also Conspiracy Stuff Show, if I'm not mistaken.
Nope, just Conspiracy Stuff.
Aha, just Conspiracy Stuff. That's obviously right. I am not a tweeter.
Hey, and if you want to be like all the people you've heard on the show today, all of your fellow listeners, just give us a call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK.
And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you don't want to do any of it. You don't like to use the phone. You don't want to go on Facebook. You don't trust the Twitters or the Instagrams or whatever. And you just want to use a relatively antiquated but still useful form of internet communicatory. You can do so where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Again, thank you so much for spending your time with us and for calling in.
Y'all are the best.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.